You're listening to BFM 89.9, the business station. The BFM Breakfast Grill. Top interviews you can't afford to miss. Presented by the CIMB Group.
Good morning. This morning on The Breakfast Grill, we have with us a man whose life has been dedicated to the cause of education. He's also a corporate figure and sits on the board of directors of several public listed companies. He's the chairman of companies such as LBI Capital Berhad, and he's also director of others like Kulim Berhad and Top Glove Corporation Berhad. Tan Sri, you are also the chairman of the board of directors of University of Malaya and the pro-chancellor of University Technology Mara. And it's probably your influential presence at the inception of Mara that marks you as one of the towering figures in the field of Malaysian education. Born in Muar Johor, Tan Sri, your extraordinary life starts at the later part of the colonial period. You were at university in the UK in the mid-50s, and you were an adult at the time of independence in Malaya in 1957, yes, and the formation of Malaysia in 1963. Yes. You've seen this country grow by leaps and bounds, and you've also seen it convulsed by political events that are a source of much contentious debate decades after the fact.
Yes.
Tan Sri, today, in the run-up to the 50th anniversary of Malaysia's formation as an independent nation-state, the perception is that Malaysian education is in crisis. The feeling is that standards have fallen drastically, that some of our once prestigious institutions of higher education are in a state of disrepair, that the slightest demand for meritocracy is resisted. There are calls for the English language to be reinstated as the medium of instruction. And our government, the government of the day, has acknowledged some of these concerns with its own reform agenda called the Education Blueprint. And I wanted maybe to ask you, paint a picture of life under colonialism, the educational opportunities that you seem to have had extraordinary access to, despite the kind of social conditions that that were the background of your personal life. Tan Sri, what was it like growing up in Muar in those years?
Well, when you live in Muar before the war in 1940s, 41, it's a different type of thing, you know. You have to walk to school, there is no bus provided, there is no hostel provided. And of course, the only English school at that time for the whole of Muar is only Government English School Muar, and the other one, Government English Preparatory School Muar, and there is some sort of a private school called the St. Andrews. And even the whole state of Johor, the only secondary school that we have in terms of English, which provides for overseas Cambridge School Certificate exam, is the English College Johor Bahru in Muar. And the rest of the school all over Malaysia will be PFS, the Penang Free School, and then the VI, Victoria Institution, Anderson School, Ipoh, and of course there's the odd one, the Malay College, Kuala Kangsa, and King Edward VII's Taiping, King George V in Seremban. In other words, most of the educational opportunities at that time, whose medium of instruction was English, is mostly in the bigger cities, actually. So then, you know, and this is the question of what are the opportunities for the rural student? I tell you, it's very rare. It's very rare to get the opportunity. So for example, the whole district of Muar, in 1937, only 60 of us had the chance to go to the English school. Although at that time, we have the Technical College of Kuala Lumpur, we have College of Agriculture Seredang, and we have also the University of Malaya in Singapore, starting in 1949, actually. But before that, we had the Raffles College of Singapore and King Edward VII Medical College. And we have also another in terms of educational facilities is for the Malay School, Vernacular School, Sultan Idris Training College, and later the Malay Women Teachers Training College.
Speaking about Malay schools, are we talking about the pondok system or are we just talking about a modern Malay school?
No, it's not a pondok system. It's a modern Malay school. But at that time, you have the school mostly open, and the separation of class from Standard 1, Standard 2, Standard 3, Standard 4 is only by the blackboard.
I see. And did Malay schools provide the kind of social mobility that English schools provided?
No, it doesn't. Unless, of course, you have the opportunity to go to the Sultan Idris Training College, which you become a teacher. And that's all. Or for the religious school, if they go another 1 or 2 years, they can go become a religious school teacher.
Tan Sri, your father died during the war and your mother soon after. You came from a background that apparently was quite deprived. How did you get the opportunity to go to school?
Actually, I was very determined to go to school. Although I'm affected by, I suffered later typhoid and malaria. When I took my overseas school certificate examination in December 48, I had malaria. I was shivering. So maybe that's the reason why I couldn't get a grade one. I landed up with a grade two. But I think with a good grade two, actually, with distinction in elementary maths. Now, the opportunities, I was really determined. I have to walk to school, and sometime I get lift from my school who comes all the way from Parit Jawa, Parit Bakar, and get a lift on their bicycle. And of course, at one time, the teacher who taught me geography, Mr. Shim Kafu, lent me his bicycle. He lives about a quarter of a mile from the school. So when he finishes his teaching and so on, he lent me his bike, and then I cycle in the morning. So, and then there is, of course, another teacher, Mr. Gordon Ward, and I am very thankful to him, who decided, said, look, it's enough for you to pedal your trishaw and earn your income. You stop pedaling trishaw and I give you 20 ringgit a month for 2 years when I was in standard 8 and 9, the school certificate. And this is the man who helped me in a way.
What accounts for that kind of generosity?
Well, I do not know. He must have taken pity on me. I mean, you know, I have my record as a very poor student. But I think, look at in the class, I probably among the top five or top six students, but who are poor. People do not realize when you live in the rural areas, there's a lot of handicap which you cannot recover within 20 years, you know. The reading, the amount of reading, the amount of environment and the exposure. And this is one of the things until today, and why when I was running the ITM, we tried to get rid, minimize this lack of exposure. And that's why I think we had, you know, later to have a lot of students and exposed to many type of nationality of lecturers. We have the ITM then, it's called. We have Japanese, we have German, we have Russian, we have British, Australian, New Zealand, Canadian, Indian, all sorts of lecturers. In fact, one time, I remember when I look at the percentage, nearly 90% of my lecturers at ITM then, from 1965 to 1975, 10 years, are mostly non-Malay lecturers, actually. And this is what I call the enrichment to the student. And then when we met the Ohio University people, you know, through our own diploma and so on, we started our twinning program, though. And this was the beginning of us having more American-oriented education lecturers to UITM. And we sent our own ordinary degree, honors degree lecturers to Ohio University and to America, either to go for their masters or PhDs. And one of them is, of course, Dr. Lee Faon, who later became the INTI vice chancellor. International.
I want to rewind back a little bit before Independence 57. I think maybe for a lot of Malaysians who grew up after independence, we don't have a sense of what it would mean to live in a country where you're not a citizen, where you don't have your full rights.
Well, this is very interesting. I mean, studied in UK for 4 years. Well, at that time, when you talk about 1954 to 58, there's a little bit of color bar and so on. So, of course, you know, if people, you don't go where people you're not wanted, why should you just transgress their area? You don't. But I have a lot of friends. I never felt in the whole of my university days that there have been a color bar against you because you're colored. There's none. But actually, I spent a lot of time with my friends who were my classmates, my university mate, stayed in their farm, stayed in their home, and so on. I really enjoyed myself in the United Kingdom. And I was very active. I was the president of Overseas Student Society, and I was one of the vice president of the residential hall, Penticallen. And also, I was a vice captain for badminton and so on. So I think it's just up to us, you know, to fit into their society for the next four years. And this is where I think I learned quite a lot. And knowing since I started life very poor, so it makes no difference, actually. And I was, and I really, when I was 4 years studying, I do save some money, you know. I brought back £400 when I came back after four years. And with that £400, and I promised before my mother died, because she sold her last acre of land. So I said, look, I will replace your acre of land. I bought an acre of land at that time for 2,000 ringgit.
UMNO had already established itself in 1954. I think the PAP was established, or some group had already formed in England. What was your relationship to the nationalist movement? Did you feel that you wanted to join it, or did you hold back?
Yeah, actually, when I was young, I was very active in the GPMS, Gabungan Penuntut Melayu Semenanjung. When I was in College of Agriculture, from 51 to 54, we went to Singapore, we attended meetings and so on. But for some reason or rather, I did not want to join any at that time, did not join to any political party. But that does not mean I am not politically conscious. And when we got our independence, when we obtained our independence in 1957, I was in London, and we came to, I think, Dorchester Hotel, the Declaration of Independence, and Trafalgar Square. And then, not many of us then. But then in 1963, when we had Malaysia, I was also studying in Switzerland. So it just perhaps I don't feel that atmosphere. But, you know, in you, definitely, to be working, to be proud of being independent.
Did you think that when you were studying that you wanted to get into the field of education?
Actually, at that time, to be very honest, no. I never thought I would go to the field of education because I want to join the Malayan Civil Service. But being in the Malayan Civil Service, now they call it Pegawai Tadbir and Diplomatic, you have a chance to serve everywhere. Of course, I serve in the Ministry of Trade and Industry, and I serve as an assistant economist in RIDA at that time, Rural Industrial Development Authority, dealing with the poor and so on, and the deprived, and trying to promote RIDA, to promote and encourage Malays to go into the industry and business. And this is where, when I was seconded to ITM in 1965, that time it was called Dewan Latihan RIDA, I had already a reasonably good background. First, I belonged to what they call the deprived Malay. And then second one, through all failures, ill health, poverty, family bereavement, I managed to overcome it. And I had a diploma in agriculture, and then I had a degree in economic statistics with a base of pure mathematics. And then later, I went to the business school, and I was promoting industrial development in Malaysia before I went to Switzerland in 1960-64, when I did at the business school called IMD at that time, now IMD, one of the two top business schools in the world, actually. So this is the type of background that I had. So when I was made the ITM, the idea was there to promote an alternate to the University of Malaya education, the traditional one.
I'm speaking to Tan Sri Dato' Arshad Ayub, a corporate figure who has deep roots in the shaping of Malaysia's public education landscape. After this, more about the trajectory of Malaysian education and Tan Sri's views on the challenges ahead.
BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutan, and if you just joined us today on The Breakfast Grill, we had Tan Sri Dato' Arshad Ayub, a corporate figure who has deep roots in the shaping of Malaysia's public education landscape. He is the chairman of the Board of Directors of University of Malaya and Pro-Chancellor of University Technology MARA. There are a lot of contentious issues when we talk about education in Malaysia. MARA, some years ago, talked about opening up its student body to non-Bumiputra students and students led a protest. Do you think, looking back over the years, that it was a mistake perhaps to have an educational institution that was solely for one part of the Malaysian community?
Mm-hmm. No, I don't think it was a mistake, because the idea was at that time, don't forget, when you look at the history of higher educational institution, in 1965, at earliest, before we were independent, there was a place called Dewan Latihan RIDA. That's how it originated. They're trying to train the colonial master at that time, understand that the Malays must be encouraged to do business. And so on, to do into the industry. The industry not can it to be working in the field. And there was no professional Malay. I remember in those days, in 1957, there were only two or three Malay doctors in the state of Johor. Dr. Saleh, Dr. Hamza, the two I remembered, and only one Malay engineer. They used to call him, nickname him Ahmad Hong Kong, because he studied engineering in Hong Kong. So there are very few Malay professionals, except some Malay civil servant. So there is lack of Malays into the business and industrial sector. So as a result of that, and I think especially after 1969, when we had our riot and we had our new economic policy, and the new economic policy government decided to have a two-pronged attack, and that is eradication of poverty irrespective of race, and the other one is restructuring of our society. So that the Indians are not only in the estate, the Malays are not working in only in the paddy field, the Chinese not only doing business. And this is a deliberate and affirmative attempt by the government from 1969 under the new economic policy. And it works very well. And because of this, we were looking, there's not enough Malays. The University of Malaya was the only institution. The admission was limited. Technical College and College of Agriculture. So Dewan Latihan Rida, and then I was asked to be seconded by the late Tun Razak to see what I could do for the Dewan Latihan Rida.
You know, there is an impression that while the affirmative action policies opened up opportunities for students, on the other hand, in terms of staff and promotions and heads of departments, that also became a question of ethnic representation.
Yes, yes.
And that, you know, and in contrast with your experience, you know, you said, you know, many of your teachers were extraordinarily cosmopolitan.
Yes, very cosmopolitan. You're
but
right.
Has that changed? Has, in fact, institutions like Mara become much more parochial as a consequence of the kind of ethnic dynamics that have been introduced into education?
I won't use the word parochial, but I think in terms of the dynamic of races, maybe there are now today more Bumi and Malay lecturers who comes to... You know, but at the same time, I believe, you must also have a good number of percentage. I mean, it doesn't matter. I think I don't mind as long even if you have 80 or 90% of the faculty members at UITM. As long as the students at the Bumiputra kept at 100%, the lecturers, I think, because it's through the lecturers, through the faculty members, that the student will benefit a lot from them. This is the experience which I came through over the 10 years, from 1965 to 1975, and almost until the years beyond 10 or 15 years. The effect there is tremendous, you know.
Well, why not a mixed student body? Why not open it up to non-Bumiputra students?
Well, I think if you talk about non-Bumiputra students today, because most of them, you know, their education is not enough, because there's a lot of what we call improving the low level, the qualification of the student. And this, we need it.
Even though 4 decades on, do you think, you know, that Bumiputra students still need this special kind of environment where they're not competing with non-Bumiputra students?
No, one thing is certain, they are ready to compete, you know. Oh no, they are in my lectures during my graduation. I always emphasize, everywhere I go, life is very competitive. Nobody owes anybody a living, whether you're a Malay, Chinese, Indian or mixed blood, or if you're from Sarawak and so on, nobody owes you a living. That's the spirit that I keep on implanting on the UITM student as a pro-chancellor. But I think, on the other hand, we have already a lot of places available. If you look at other private universities, I think 95% of them are non-Bumiputra, non-Malay student. This is partly to compensate for it. I do think if you talk about bringing non-Malay student for the sake of unity, for the sake of mixing as well, I don't think it helps, because I can see what's going on in other universities. This is always the tendency that people crowd together. It makes no difference. But I think, to me, it is very important the time to come. Anyway, those people today, we have more Bumiputra or Malay lecturers who are better qualified.
There was a shift a couple of decades into the NEP, allowing a liberalization of the higher education system in particular. Has this been good? It seems to be a lot of people are now aspiring to university education. Are we all qualified to go to university?
Frankly, if you ask me, not all of us were at the university, are qualified to go to university at that time. But it can take a longer time. What I think what people should do begins life, not all. Before going to university, try and do the diploma first or do some vocational work first. So when you're ready to go to university, which I think only today at the university level, only half of the university are ready to go to the university. I'm not worried so much of the entrance qualification, but I'm more worried is the outcome, the graduates. What kind of graduates do we expect from a particular university? And this is the most important thing. And I think as an employer, people like to see that when you're able to work, you must be able at least to meet, to bridge the gap between the university and the industry. But this is the question. I think we must go for the quality.
Now, can we go for quality if the aspiration, for instance, is to increase foreign student intake to, you know, from the present, I think, 80,000 to some 200,000? That seems to be the stated aspirations. We want numbers. Can we still have quality if our targets are set in terms of numbers?
Well, if you talk about numbers, when you want to train 80,000, 200,000, you must have the number in the faculty. So I mentioned, for example, we have in the government of the 9 faculty of medicine. Now, where are the numbers the faculty are coming from? And so is a private university. Where are the faculty coming from? Where do we get the faculty to make sure that the quality is maintained? But of course, when you see a bigger number, the first reaction is always think, quality and quantity are diametrically opposed. I think it not be. So the question is now, we rely on each and every higher educational institution to see the quality is there.
Speaking of English, you obviously grew up in a time where English was the language of power. You know, we had the shift post-independence. We had aspirations for a national language to unify people. Yes. But as a result, we left English behind. Now yes. There are calls for the reinstatement of English as a medium of instruction. What are your views on the question, that very prickly question of English?
English is no more the language of powerful nation. It's no more the language of select island race. It's not no more the language of our colonial master, no more. But today I like to say it's almost the language of all mankind. And to that, you must only, as a Malaysian, you must speak Malaysia, Bahasa Malaysia fluently, English fluently, and another language, either Mandarin, Japanese, Arabic, and so on. Because these are the languages of business as well. So if you ask me, we should at least speak 3 languages. Then we call ourselves real global.
Tan Sri, do you think far too few educationists are weighing in on questions of education, and far too many politicians are determining, often based on vague notions of patriotism and ethnic pride, on the question of education? Do you think there's too much political interference in our education system?
Basically, we cannot run away from the politics of the day. Because it's politics that make us, actually. But the question is this, politicians and politics must also understand what is good for the nation, for the 28 million people in the country. Well, people always argue, the Japanese, you know, they have their own language, they have more than 200 million people, so why not we use Bahasa Malaysia as a medium of instruction? I think the answer is yes. We should have. We must be proud of the fact. I mean, we cannot call ourselves a Malaysian if we cannot speak Bahasa Malaysia. If we don't, we are not able to use Bahasa Malaysia. But on the other hand, being a small nation, about 28 million, and if you're going to be talk about globalization, and we talk about looking at the future, we have to improve, not in addition to Bahasa Malaysia, but we have to improve our standard of English. If you think our standard of English is low, we must improve it, because that's the important. Basically, most of the sources of knowledge and so on come from the English language, actually.
Finally, Tan Sri, when you look back at your illustrious career, you look back at the kind of choices that you made in the field of education, what do you think were the blind spots? What do we not anticipate in trying to shape our education system, in trying to achieve the aspirations, very legitimate aspirations of an education system that would deliver social mobility for all, rural and urban, poor and rich?
I think number one, we have to sum up a blind spot is this opportunity. opportunity and accessibility to primary education and secondary education, which includes vocational. We never look at back of the mirror when you drive it, so I think we have left that vocational. I think we should revive this vocational education because there's a lot of opportunities in the vocational education. And secondly, I think in our desire to become a center for international education, we have to make sure that the quality, we must have good teachers, good faculty members, and so on and so forth. And thirdly, we cannot run away from the fact that for the future, I think English, much English is important, and we must try at the same time not to miss to use Bahasa Malaysia as much as we can.
Thank you very much. I've been speaking to Tan Sri Dato' Arshad Ayub, a Malaysian educationist and corporate figure. He's on the board of many public listed companies. He's also chairman of the board of directors of University Malaya and pro-chancellor of University Technology Mara. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure. I'm Sharad Kutin for BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill was brought to you by the CIMB Group, Southeast Asia's leading universal bank. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.